Hi, everybody. Welcome to the final F This Movie of 2010. Also, the final F This Movie of the decade. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined tonight by a very, very special guest, my DVD verdict slash daily verdict colleague and Edgar Wright's BFF, Eric Asperschlager, all the way from New York. How are you, Eric?
Good, good. Patrick, how are you doing?
I'm okay. What are you and Edgar up to this New Year's?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously, it's nothing too fancy. I mean, he's been doing a lot of promotion for the Scott Pilgrim Blu-ray and the movie, and so it keeps him busy. Just a quiet evening in.
Okay.
Maybe a fire. I don't have a fireplace, but you never know. And, you know, just maybe some canapes.
Is there, like, maybe, like, a Cake Boss marathon in your future?
Oh, man, I hadn't thought that far ahead, but do you think there'll be a Cake Boss marathon?
I think there's always a Cake Boss marathon.
I don't know where we're going with this bit, but I am certainly honored to be here. I didn't know how you introduced me, so I think that was a darn fine introduction.
I was going to go with Gorgeous Woman.
Well, you've never actually met me in person, so
right.
I could just be deep-voiced, you know.
Yeah, that's right. We have never actually met. We have corresponded via Skype and email.
Yeah, primarily the electronic mail service that I get through AOL.
But this is an F This Movie first. I'm sensing a theme for this show.
Letters?
Disappointment, actually.
No, it's good. Well, I did sort of want to kick off the podcast, I think, as all good podcasts start, with a preemptive apology to the audience. You know, I mean, I listen to the show regularly. It is a fine, fine program. I really do enjoy it. And you know, you're on with your friends, with your your compadres. I think that's a word.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people you've known for a long time. You have very good chemistry with them. You know, there's a real. It keeps the energy up. We, of course, have never met. We're doing this over Skype. I can't look into your eyes and, you know, kind of anticipate what you're thinking and feeling. I'm glad you're bringing me on for this experiment because
I'm glad you're here. And the thing is, you don't even need to apologize because this is F This Movie. The apology is always implied. There's just an implicit apology always when you're listening to F This Movie.
That's right. I forgot that was actually your, it's your tagline, right?
That's right.
At this movie, the apology is implied.
So housekeeping nonsense. fthismovie.blogspot.com is our website. fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com is our email address. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. We're getting ready to do a top 10 show for 2010. So obviously, if you want to submit a top 10 list, then fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. And I think we have a Twitter, however that works. So tweet us, Twitter us, follow us on Twitter. Be our Twitter friend. I don't understand the Twitter.
I feel like I'm already derailing the podcast just by being here. Like, you don't know exactly what's going on with the – I can't help you with the housekeeping.
No, no.
This is all new to me. Usually this is – I'm listening to this. You're saying this stuff normally, so I'm intended not to say anything. Although I do frequently talk back to my iPad.
Oh, good.
You don't respond, which is why I'm pretty sure you hate me. But
before we get into the movie that we're talking about tonight, I have to ask a question that I always ask of my co-hosts on the show, and that is, Eric, have you seen anything good lately?
I have, partly thanks to you, and I think it was your last episode you guys talked about The Big Lebowski. Is that correct?
That is correct.
That is correct. And this is a movie I'm sad to say, for some reason, 12 years have gone by, and I had never seen the movie. And I had it in my Netflix instant watch queue forever, just, you know, trying to find time. I saw that you guys had done the episode.
Mm-hmm.
I said to myself, I want to listen to this episode. I better watch the movie. So I did.
Nice.
And I enjoyed it. I think I probably had, based on, you know, what you guys were talking about, I think I had the right response to the movie, which is I really enjoyed it, but I was not, you know, head over heels for it,
right,
which I think comes with multiple viewings. Probably not unlike the movie we're going to be talking about tonight.
Yeah, but, that was my reaction to The Big Lebowski, as I said on that podcast, and you're exactly right in terms of Scott Pilgrim, because the first time I saw it, I thought, boy, I really liked that, and I'm positive I have to see that about six more times before I can fully appreciate it.
Yep, exactly. So I really enjoyed it, and I definitely appreciated listening to the cast last week, because it illuminated certain things, and as you're bringing up various quotes and scenes, I said, boy, that is funnier. That is a lot funnier than I thought it was the first time I saw it. So I have to watch that again.
That podcast, unfortunately, to some extent, did devolve into the Chris Farley show, which is just, hey, remember this? That was awesome. And we try very hard not to do that. But every once in a while, when we're talking about a movie we really like, that happens. So we do run the risk of that happening tonight.
It's a definite possibility. I'm sad to say. I will try to come up with criticisms or just nasty things to say about it. Although with Edgar in the other room, I got to keep the voice down.
That could be awkward. Make sure you have headphones on in case I say anything critical, or just that he's got the volume way up on Glee, which I assume he's watching.
Yeah, we're trying to catch up. The Christmas episode, we hadn't seen that yet, so he's just kind of wrapping it up. They're singing some song.
Yeah,
I wish I could have come up with something funny there, but
I saw Tron Legacy.
Oh, okay.
And it was terrible.
It was actually terrible. I feel like I've heard kind of mixed things, but yeah. It was actively bad.
I think it was actively bad. I mean, it was at least active. It was bad in a way that like you could talk about and you could sort of dissect the ways in which it was bad, which to me is a lot more interesting than just a movie like Grown Ups or something, or like Cats and Dogs 2, The Revenge of Kitty Galore, which I have not seen, but I have every reason to assume you would see that movie and say, well, that was terrible, and there's not much else to say about it. At least Tron Legacy, you could talk about all the ways in which it fails, and I think that's because it was a movie that had some potential. I mean, I saw the trailer. I was interested. I think the first Tron is at least sort of an interesting mess. So I definitely had an interest in seeing the sequel, and I was hugely disappointed.
Primarily, it lacked any kind of heart, any kind of soul.
It lacked anything. I mean, I would love to say it was just this empty exercise in style, but even the style was just sort of boring. For as much money as is on the screen, it's basically just a blacklight poster. It's just black with a lot of neon, swatches everywhere. And the screenplay is filled with these sort of half-baked ideas that it never explains, and the dialogue can all be boiled down to like young Anakin Skywalker saying, "Now this is pod racing," like that kind of everyone sort of narrates everything they're doing. At one point, a character opens a giant door and then says, "Now that's a big door."
The script writes itself, is what you're saying.
Basically,
it's really.
There's a scene. All right, not to get into spoilers with Tron Legacy, but the basic premise is Jeff Bridges has been. It's gone for years and years, almost two decades. His son hasn't seen him. His son finally meets him after, 20 years by being physically beamed into a computer and now is physically inhabiting cyberspace. So A, that's a lot to get over. B, he's seeing his father for the first time in 20 years. They encounter each other. They hug. And then Jeff Bridges is like, "We have a lot to talk about, but dinner first. We'll talk later."
And I assume over the dinner scene, they play The Cats in the Cradle and The Silver Spoon.
Well, of course. But it just seems to me like, boy, that these people probably have a lot to say to one another, including, "Hey, I noticed you've been beamed into a computer like me." But instead he says, "Let's have dinner. We'll talk later."
It's an odd failing of movies and TV shows alike that people just don't ask questions they would normally ask in real life, or even just, I mean, this is, kind of a tangent, but people don't say goodbye when they hang up the phone.
Right.
And no one eats. They go to restaurants, they order food, and they leave. And it's so bizarre. So maybe this whole being beamed to the computer thing is not that strange.
Maybe it's just something that everybody accepts pretty quickly.
It's kind of less strange than, you know, ordering an expensive meal at a restaurant and then walking out 2 minutes later. But
Doug, who is a frequent co-host of F This Movie, that was one of his gripes about Lost. And I know you're a big Lost fan. Yep. But that it was constantly like characters would ask very legitimate questions about things that are going on. And the response by the other character was always like, we don't have time for that now. Let's do this other thing. It's like, no, answer that. It's a one sentence response. Like, you can answer that and then go about your business. But it was always like, oh, we don't have time for that.
It happens all the time. I mean, Lost is certainly an example of where you really do want to know what's going to happen, and right. They do not give it to you.
But enough talking about bad movies like Tron Legacy. Let's talk about a good movie. Let's talk about Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Cats and Dogs 2.
The Revenge of Kitty Galore?
Yeah, but if you ever want to do a Cats and Dogs 2 F This Movie, let me know.
Okay.
Because I will have to watch the movie and then find out, formulate an opinion, and then we can do it.
Was Kitty Galore in the first Cats and Dogs?
Probably not. Because I have not seen Cats and Dogs.
I think I did, actually, and oddly enough, I don't remember a lot about it. But I feel like it's another one of those situations where it's like Transformers 2 Revenge of the Fallen, mm-hmm. where then you find out like, oh, the Fallen isn't a reference to the bad guys who fell in the first movie, or even a character from the first movie. It's this new character that has come out of nowhere called the Fallen, who is taking revenge. And I don't feel like you should do that in a movie. I feel like if you're going to say revenge of so-and-so, it should be a reference to something we know or have seen in a previous movie.
That makes sense. I mean, I have seen The Truth About Cats and Dogs.
Okay.
I do not remember a Kitty Galore in that movie.
No, that was an Uma Thurman's name, right?
I spent a long time, so.
Yeah. I used to watch that movie a lot because I had a major Janine Garofalo crush.
Okay. I heard an interesting theory. I think I heard this on This American Life or something. Someone posited that the way you can tell whether a movie is good or bad is to ask yourself whether it's better or worse than The Truth About Cats and Dogs. The Truth About Cats and Dogs being the ultimate median point for all movie comparison. So you can...
That is an outstanding theory.
It is. I try to use that. Whenever I'm writing reviews, I usually start with that question. So we can ask ourselves, is Scott Pilgrim versus the World better or worse than The Truth About Cats and Dogs?
I think we're going to have a pretty definitive answer.
I would posit better.
Now the way that you came to be the co-host of the Scott Pilgrim versus the World F This Movie episode was you wrote a very thorough and insightful review of the film when it was released on Blu-ray for our the website that we both write for, DVDverdict.com, soon to be DailyVerdict.com. And your review was so thorough and insightful that Edgar Wright himself tweeted it that day, correct?
That is a true story. And as far – at least for a good period of time of that day and perhaps even the day after, mine was the only review that he called out for his Twitter followers.
That is incredible.
It was incredible. I mean, I understand that I'm supposed to have journalistic integrity, although not that I'm a journalist. But, you know, I know I'm supposed to maintain some distance from my subjects.
Right.
But that was awesome.
Yeah.
As a person who, you know, writes for an internet website, that was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
That was cool. So apparently he liked what I had to say about it. And
it also makes you the most famous person ever to appear on F This Movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know who I am.
Except for that time we had the girl who played Vicky the robot on Small Wonder. But her and I did a great show on AI.
But even
she thought the last act went on too long.
Yeah, right. So that's how I got involved in this, and I wrote to you. We had some email conversations about the movie, yes. And I said, hey, if you ever want to do a show about it, let me insert myself into your very popular podcast.
That's right. I jumped all over that.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Go ahead.
No. I'm trying to figure out the best way to sort of get into the discussion of Scott Pilgrim versus the World. I feel like, okay, so the movie came out in August of 2010. It's directed by Edgar Wright, who is great and who has never made anything bad. And then it was quickly clobbered at the box office and disappeared, much to the dismay of its fans. And now that the sort of year-end 10 best lists are coming out, a lot of the internet, of course, the sort of fan sites, your Ain't It Cools, your Chuds, your Badass Digests, are once again lauding the movie as one of the best movies of the year, which, of course, has now inspired the inevitable backlash from some of the, I guess, pop culture elite who claim that it's overrated.
I missed this particular controversy.
You need to really be in the mix of the internet,
I guess.
The Googles, the America Onlines.
I did not see it on Google News or Dig.com, so I missed it.
See, I was physically beamed into a computer where I ran into my father, and uh-huh. He told me that people are calling Scott Pilgrim overrated. So let's just get into your personal feelings about Edgar Wright's Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
I have to say that the first time I watched it, and because I reviewed it, I actually ended up watching it multiple times, which was a happy, not accident, but I'm glad I did because I don't always do that. The first time I watched it, I really, really enjoyed it. And I think I was all prepared to give it what was effectively a 9 out of 10 score. I thought it was really good. And then I watched it another time, a second time, and it's something really clicked. All the just the pacing and the rhythm and the style and just the layer upon layer of detail hit me, and I left there just kind of just floored by the movie. I ended up giving it my only perfect score that I've ever given a movie, which may be one of the reasons why Edgar Wright liked my review. But I think it's really a remarkable movie. Edgar Wright, as you said, is an amazing director, and I would go so far as to say I think this is his best movie, if only because it kind of takes everything he does so well and just kind of distills it and just takes it to the next level. It's a really ambitious movie, and it never falters. For me, it doesn't anyway.
I'm back and forth on where I feel it sort of falls within Edgar Wright's oeuvre, his canon, his body of work. I'm just going to find different ways of saying the same thing.
Joie de vivre.
That sounds good. Because while I think it's definitely his most ambitious and his most technically accomplished, I think he's really pushing things in a new direction. Which, just quick sidebar, I think it's interesting that a lot of the reviews, especially the positive reviews, continue to say, like, he's pushing cinema forward, and this is a watershed movie that I think is going to be sort of copied for years and years to come. And I disagree with that. I think what he does stylistically is really right for this particular material, but I don't think it's the kind of thing that can be applied to just any other movie.
I think you're right about that. Although I may have said it in my reviews as well. I think it does change the visual language of the movies, and I might be wrong, but it seems to me that it's kind of the first mainstream movie to really kind of speak in a language that those of us who hang out on the internet and browse forums and go to these websites kind of get. It's not a Hollywood visual language. It makes reference to things. It makes reference to all kinds of things, obviously video games and music and computers and things we'll probably end up talking about. But but it doesn't do it in a kind of Family Guy, I am making a reference sort of way.
Right.
It basically portrays these characters as living in a world or living a life where this is just their vocabulary. This is the way they interact with the world. Mm-hmm. The same way that I might be talking to someone about something serious, and then it all of a sudden reminded me of a Simpsons quote,
right.
And I feel the need to share that. It's that kind of, not ADD, but that kind of way of approaching the world that you don't see in movies. And I think you're probably right that you can't do that with every movie. I mean, it's not like you can take the next, Social Network 2 and make it this way, but
Social Network 2, The Revenge of Kitty Galore. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and that's the working title. I haven't finalized it yet, but you're gonna You're going to like the third act.
I mean, I definitely feel like Scott Pilgrim is sort of a polarizing movie. And I don't mean to say that it's like an us versus them kind of a thing, or even a generational shift where it's like, hey, man, you're too old for this. You don't get our movie. But there's definitely, I think, elements of, say, The Graduate in the movie, more than just for those reasons where it's definitely sort of it speaks to a generational divide. And that's the movie that always gets referenced when you're talking about movies that, you know, are a generational divide. I think the last really big one, I think, was Fight Club. But I think this – I think the people that – how do I say this? The people that thought that Fight Club really spoke to them are not the same people that feel like Scott Pilgrim speaks to them.
No, right.
And a lot of people, I think, were really left cold by the movie. I don't think it's the kind of movie that you could be sort of indifferent towards. It's like you either really love it or you just throw up your hands and you say, I don't get this. Because I think there's a lot of people who do – who would argue that the references and the touches here and there are just for the sake of being references to sort of engender a coolness factor with young people. But I – agree with you 100% that that it is just the language that the characters speak in. This is the world that they inhabit, and this is the first movie to really sort of pull from all these different sources. And that Scott Pilgrim, you know, there's that little moment where there's a little Seinfeld, that little bass cue, you know, and I guess on the one hand, you could be sitting in the audience saying, well, what the hell was that? Why did they do that? Just to make a Seinfeld reference. But I think, you know, obviously the point Edgar Wright is making is that Scott Pilgrim very much views himself as, you know, either the star of his own TV show or the main character in his own video game. But the movie never explicitly comes out and says that. So if you don't sort of get that, you know, you're almost going to not understand the central conceit of the movie. Why are they suddenly fighting like they're in a video game? Am I supposed to take this literally? And I think there's a lot of people who felt that when the movie came out, that we were supposed to take all of that completely literally, that people really did just have this ability to fight and that all that goes on, instead of understanding, you know, that it's a metaphor.
Yeah. So it's an interesting point you make about the way Scott views the world. It reminds me a lot of a TV show that we both like very much, Community.
Yes.
And the character of Abed, who, you know, you could basically look at the entire series through his point of view. This is a character whose reference to the world at large are the TV shows that he, you know, watched. It's all about conflict and resolution and this character getting a week off and all this kind of stuff. And it's the same kind of thing here. And that might be analogous in some way to say that you can do this in a different medium, or, you know, not just in Scott Pilgrim, but but yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of the referential stuff in Scott Pilgrim comes from Brian Lee O'Malley's original graphic novel series, which I actually read before I saw the movie, although I didn't read them until after the movie had come out. I didn't get around to seeing the movie until it came out on Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. But I did read the series and enjoyed it. I mean, they're similar. They're different beasts. Have you read any of them? Or
I have not.
Okay. I mean, they're enjoyable. They're different in a lot of ways. It's a 6-book series, and by book I mean like thick 100-some-odd page book.
Right.
So there's a lot of material in there, and I think what I was afraid of after reading them and going to watch the movies, that it would just feel too compressed, which is something that happens a lot, obviously, when any kind of book is adapted for you know, a sub-2-hour movie, but. So Brian Lee O'Malley has a lot of the references, you know, when Scott gets the one up, some of the noises, the way that, you know, words appear in the air, to indicate sounds, a lot of that kind of stuff. And that comes from his history with anime, with video games, all that kind of really nerdy stuff. Mm-hmm. I think what Wright adds to it, one of the reasons the movie is successful as an adaptation, is that he doesn't just kind of reproduce what was on the page, but adds a whole other layer to it too, because he understands that, you know, what's on the page is on the page and it's a static drawing, but when you put it on screen, you got the ability to do things with movement, you got the, you know, and color and audio. I mean, the audio in this movie is just astounding. Mm-hmm. But What was the question?
Well, you know, all of Edgar Wright's movies have definitely trafficked in pop culture and pop culture references, whether it's sort of sending up the zombie movie genre in Shaun of the Dead or the buddy cop movie in Hot Fuzz. And he's always able to pull off that very difficult trick of sending something up, but also functioning as that thing where you're, mm-hmm. you're making fun of zombie movie conventions, but you're also very much utilizing them and working as a great zombie movie. And he doesn't exactly do that here. Obviously he's using pop culture references in a different way, in a way that's in some ways very much more on the nose and in a lot of ways way more subtle. But I'm really glad that he's the guy to make this movie. And honestly, I don't know that the movie gets made unless somebody like Edgar Wright says, I want to make Scott Pilgrim into a movie. But I could see a very different version of this movie done by McG, you know, not to just bag on McG
because sure,
he's such a whipping boy, but where it's like the references are there because he read the book and he knows that there's supposed to be the references, but you could just see a different sort of Hollywood version of this movie that's made by committee. Whereas Edgar Wright, you really feel like, as much as he's adapting this from somebody else's book, and as much as, like you said, a lot of it comes from Brian Lee O'Malley, that it was already in the book, you feel like this is all very much coming out of Edgar Wright, and the references are to the things that he loves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's what is kind of the hallmark of all of his movies, is that he's legitimately a fan of this stuff. I mean, he wouldn't make this if he wasn't a fan of these genres and of these conventions. I mean, you could almost say that for all the video game references, for all the, you know, I guess you always come back to video game, comic book, all that stuff. It's in the movie. And this is more a setup of kung fu movies than anything else.
Right.
And he's kind of described it as, you know, a musical where people break into fights instead of songs. And that's kind of what it is. I mean, the whole movie does have the pacing of a musical. I mean, you got the mm-hmm. interludes, and it's very, very rhythmic. I think it's one of the reasons why it's so fun to watch and rewatch, is because you kind of get into the rhythm and pick up little cues and little asides that by themselves wouldn't be terribly funny, but just mm-hmm. in the context of the movie, for some reason are really hilarious. So it's almost more about the fight scenes than it is about and the choreography and all that stuff than it is about the fact that, you know, Ramona can pull a hammer a la Donkey Kong out of her purse, or that they could be talking about him dating Knives Chow and the Legend of Zelda music is punctuating the dialogue in the background and stuff.
Right. Well, and also, you know, in musicals, the characters break into song at moments where, you know, say words won't cut it, where they are forced to express themselves through music and dance because the emotions are so big that simple dialogue won't suffice. And this movie does the same thing, but with fight sequences. It's like there's a point where words won't do it anymore and they need to express themselves in a different way. And they happen to do it through fighting, but again, it's that stylized fighting of again, video games. And I will say that as much as I love Scott Pilgrim versus the World, and as much as I feel like I still need to live with it longer and see it more times, because there's so much going on in that movie that it takes obviously multiple viewings to get. It is to some extent a movie that makes me feel old. It makes me feel out of touch. And I think I'm around the same age as Edgar Wright, but I'm not somebody who plays video games. I never really have. I'm not as like into music as I once was. So I'm out of touch with like the whole indie band scene thing. So like when there's a Flash Gordon reference, I totally get that. But I mean, you just pointing out the Legend of Zelda music, I didn't catch that. Right. I don't get that reference. So there's all this stuff going on that's going over even my head, even though I consider myself a pretty pop culture savvy viewer.
Yeah, and I don't know if that has to do with age per se, because pretty much all the references we're talking about are references that people of our generation would get. I mean, the original Super Mario Brothers, for instance, is not a game that is being played by 10-year-olds right now.
Right.
Maybe on emulator on the internet somewhere, but you know, I mean, like Flash Gordon and all that kind of stuff, it references kind of an 80s culture, something that would, you know, would fit in with Brian Lee O'Malley and with Edgar Wright. You know, the fact that we hear computer sounds punctuating things, but there it's like the Windows 95 startup, you know, sound. It's the, you know, the old school Mac, you know, Bing or something like that. Right, it's not right. So it's maybe not such, I don't know, age. I don't know if it has much to do with it as much as it's kind of awareness of you know, some of these things.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you're old. So let's not.
Oh, I'm old. I'm plenty old. I do like that the movie plays this game. It's very much, again, I think a movie made for our generation, but also I think a generation younger, just because of the language that it uses, where it's so fast. And I think it's only, you know, a younger generation that's even able to process the amount of information on screen. So I do think it's definitely a movie that's sort of pitched at younger viewers. But at the same time, I think it's making fun of them a lot. In terms of there's little touches like the guy at the party who every time they go past him, he's saying something else sort of hipper than thou and douchey.
Yeah.
Or even in the central character of Scott Pilgrim, who's just, you know, this indecisive guy who just wants things to be easy. He doesn't really want to try that hard. And that's sort of why he's dating Knives Chow, and he doesn't want to commit to that, and he doesn't want to even break up with her when he finds something better. And that's obviously, you know, very much what the movie is about thematically, sort of growing up and taking a stand and or getting a life, as they say in the movie. But I like that as much as the movie is sort of targeted at a specific demographic, it's also being critical of that demographic, but not in like a snotty, obnoxious way, like a superior, we're so much better than you way.
Yeah, it's almost more about an age group than a specific, you know, generation.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, when we were kids, I think, you know, I think when you're a teenager, when you're in your early 20s, relationships, the idea of love and your responsibility to other people, it's different. You know, you might want to be like Scott and just sort of take the easy way out. You know, a breakup could be the most devastating thing in the world. And, you know, and that mysterious girl who roller skates through your dreams could be, you know, could be the one you might decide that she's the one. Mm-hmm. So it's so hard to say like who this movie is really targeted at. I mean, I apparently me, because I liked it, but
but I absolutely think it's that kind of movie, and I really like those kinds of movies, even if they're not necessarily for me.
Mm-hmm.
I like a movie that is very obviously that is clearly going to speak to some people very profoundly.
Yeah, and I mean there's a level of profundity to the movie. I think one of the largest criticisms that I saw leveled against it was that, you know, you never really got invested in the characters, or some people didn't anyway, or didn't feel like there was a whole lot of weight emotionally to the story. I certainly found it to be involving in that way, more so than something like, you know, say Inception.
Mm-hmm.
That really is kind of about the construction of the plot and the construction mm-hmm. of the world. And, you know, I think you could argue that Scott Pilgrim as a film is, you know, just as tightly constructed. I mean, it's everything is in exactly the place that Edgar Wright and, you know, these people want it to be. I mean, nothing's really, every beat is obviously been planned out.
Right.
But I think it maintains that core. And I think the performances are uniformly strong as well. I think that a lot of people, I think one of the reasons people didn't see the movie, maybe it was because of Michael Cera, which I think is a shame because he's awfully good in this movie.
Yeah, he definitely is. Like you said, everybody is actually really good and really memorable. And I think everybody makes the most of their screen time and carves out interesting characters for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that even Brandon Routh, who failed to make a huge impression in Superman, aside from like, wow, he's a lot like Christopher Reeve.
Yeah.
is really funny here, and you remember him. You walk away from the movie thinking Brandon Routh was great.
And it's no mean feat, because you have a lot of people who in almost any other movie would be considered, stunt casting,
right?
Or just kind of, but they don't feel out of place. It doesn't feel like, oh, they got Brandon Routh, or oh, they got, you know, Chris Evans, or Jason Schwartzman. It's like they managed to make those parts their own and feel right for the characters.
Right. While still obviously sort of having fun with those actors' respective images.
Totally. I mean, you got the fact that that Mae Whitman is in the movie opposite Michael Cera, you know, like Arrested Development, except she's no longer Anne. She's a kick-ass lesbian. I think, you know, that has an effect.
It's interesting that you bring up Inception, because obviously I think both movies, while one was significantly more successful, both have, like you said, the same criticism leveled against them, which is it is a technical achievement, a stylistic achievement, but ultimately emotionally hollow. And they both are sort of working emotionally, at least, I think, almost in the theoretical. And maybe that's where people have take issue with the movies, because, you know, Inception, it's – you don't necessarily feel a relationship between Leonardo DiCaprio and Marion Cotillard. It's just this idea of a man who feels loss and wants to get back to his kids. It's just these larger ideas instead of specific character A connected to character B. And in some ways, I think Scott Pilgrim, while the characters, I think, are better drawn than in Inception, I think there's a little bit of that too. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to segue, I think, into a discussion that we started to have over email, but that obviously we should have on the podcast too. And we're going to end up spoiling certain elements, actually many elements of Scott Pilgrim, particularly the ending. So if you haven't seen the movie yet, obviously you should have seen it a long time ago, but definitely go out and see it before you listen to anything further. Because I think Scott Pilgrim also sort of traffics in the emotionally theoretical, that Ramona Flowers represents something but fails to ever be much of a real character. Mm-hmm. And I think that's I almost think that's by design. You know, she's supposed to be just sort of this symbol. That's even the way Scott Pilgrim looks at her. And Knives mm-hmm. represents something else. And maybe it's just a function of the performances that I come away from the movie feeling like Knives Chow is a real person and Ramona Flowers is just an idea.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that they both relate back to Scott in the same way, you know, as we were talking about, that everything that happens in the movie is kind of seen through Scott's eyes.
Right.
So they both, you know, serve a function. In Knives' case, it's because he needs an easy, uncomplicated relationship after, you know, the terrible year he's had since Envy Adams broke up with him. Mm-hmm. And then for Ramona, she is literally the girl of his dreams. I mean, to bring it back to Inception, you know, she almost doesn't have to have a whole lot of substance, because he wants her only because he wants her.
He's just sort of idealized her.
Sure. And I think we start to get more of Ramona throughout the course of the movie. Although, you know, leading into our discussion of the ending, I think one of the, you know, problems with the movie is that she is kind of largely absent for the last, I don't know, 20 minutes or something.
Right.
Pretty much from the Roxy fight onward, she's out of the picture. Even at the end, the final fight scene with Gideon. She is sort of a passive observer, because they have the whole chip in the brain, whatever it is. So she becomes less kind of less important, which I think, I guess, for you, have, you know, when you saw the alternate ending, which is I think where this discussion is going.
Yeah.
She seemed like a less legitimate choice for Scott, simply, you know, because Knives was, you know, a more devoted to him.
It's not even that she was more devoted to him. I feel, maybe it's just a function of the performances, because I think Ellen Wong is really, really good in the movie in a very difficult role. And not that Mary Elizabeth Winstead is bad as Ramona Flowers, but it's just she's sort of given less to play. We don't know that much about Ramona, except she's aloof and she has a past, but she doesn't really want to talk about that much. And again, that's by design, that, like you said, she just sort of represents this thing that Scott wants. And ultimately, the movie isn't about – it's not a conventional love story in the sense that, boy, we're really pulling for these two kids to get together. It's more about us wanting Scott to reach some sort of self-actualization and grow up a little. And he does that, and so the movie succeeds on that level. When I saw the movie, I saw it the night it came out, and I was aware that they had reshot the ending. And again, we're going to spoil the ending of Scott Pilgrim, because the movie ends with Knives essentially saying, "I'm too cool for you, and it's okay, and we can still be friends, but you belong with Ramona." And Scott and Ramona sort of walk off together, and the movie ends on sort of a question mark, again, references to, I think, The Graduate, where it's, you know, Benjamin and Elaine sitting on the back of the bus. It's like, we're together, but now what? And we're not sure what the future holds for this couple. And I like that. I like that it's kind of open-ended, and we're not positive that these two are going to be happy together forever. And I was aware that that was reshot, that ultimately – that it, originally he ended up with Knives. And I remember some discussion on Facebook or something where people were saying, oh, he picks the wrong girl. The movie – messed up because Knives is so much cooler and blah, blah, blah. And at the time I defended the ending because I said, no. If he goes back to Knives, that's wrong for the movie. That suggests he hasn't matured. He's going back to this thing that's easy. He belongs with Ramona because it's the more difficult, more adult relationship. But then I watched the Blu-ray and they show the original ending. And not to completely take back what I said, but I feel like the original ending in which he does end up with Knives, I think works for the movie so much better. And it broke my heart a little that it wasn't used, because the thing that keeps – that holds me back a little from just gushing all over Scott Pilgrim is that I never fully connect to it emotionally. And like you said, that's a criticism that a lot of people have, and I'm not saying that it's, you know, totally cold or standoffish, but, you know, all of Edgar Wright's previous movies, there's this definite emotional hook, but it's always been really between friends, that it's more of a platonic relationship between two male friends, whether it's Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, basically, in both of his previous movies, that's sort of the love story, if you will. Spaced is obviously, that's the TV show he did, is I think the best example of a story like that working, where it's ultimately just about these two friends who by the end have the potential to be something more. And that's never really spelled out unless you watch that documentary on the DVD. That to me is the best example of a romantic relationship in an Edgar Wright work. So I watched the original ending, and I just feel like there's a symmetry to it. It pulls in all these things that have come before in the movie that pay off so many different elements, and I think it just works so much better from seeing the two of them again on the Dance Dance Revolution fighting game, which again ties in with this idea of, you know, how do these characters even know how to fight? Well, they play this game. And it's once again the two of them now working together as a unit, as opposed to these two, you know, separate entities that they were at the beginning of the movie. That they're a team now. They work together. And then, you know, there's the whole thing where he says, "Do you want to continue?" She says, "I don't have any coins." He says, "I do." And A, obviously that's a reference to, I've collected all these coins by defeating this baggage, by becoming a better person. I now have something to show for it. But also, at the beginning of the movie, he's mooching off of her. And now he's slightly more adult. You know, I can pay for myself. I can even pay for you. I've grown up a little. There's just all these little touches, even the way that it's shot, the two of them dancing or fighting in slow motion. I love so much, and I miss it from the theatrical cut of the movie now that I know it exists. And I've just talked for way too long, and I'm so sorry. You're so nice listen to me say all that. I'm sorry.
No. We went back and forth on this. I continue to defend the original ending. The theatrical ending.
Yeah.
And I do think that it works better for the movie. It's interesting. In some of the bonus features on the Blu-ray, I think even the commentary, you know, Edgar Rice, we're talking about the ending, says that the audience, the test audiences, were basically split down the middle. Yeah. Some felt that, you know, him going to Knives was like, well, what's the point? He just spent an entire movie trying to get this one girl, and he goes back to this other one. You know, that's kind of a stagnant thing. And other people, loved it. I kind of agree with his take, and part of it is obviously because he's sitting right here. but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for Knives. I think it makes a lot of sense for Scott, in the sense that, I guess in the original ending, it's not only the very end of the movie where he chooses her, but during the sequence when he's dead, Ramona appears to him, and in the original ending, the Knives ending, she points out that Knives has been fighting for Scott all along, and so and that's the lesson that he learns. And in the theatrical cut, that changes to Scott realizing that he needs to fight not for Ramona but for himself and for his own self-worth and for his own growth, which I think is probably the best place for the movie to go, just for Scott to kind of realize that, it's not about these girls, it's about him, fighting for his own, even just maturity, just kind mm-hmm. of his own growth. So you kind of take that, and then it really seems like if he went with Knives, why would Knives take him back? She just found out that he cheated on her, and it's kind of an emotional regression for her. I mean, she really is too cool for him by the end of the movie.
Right.
There's no real reason for her to take him back.
Mm-hmm.
As much as Scott saw her as this kind of easy, uncomplicated relationship, she saw him as this sort of lofty goal, almost like, he was her Ramona.
Right.
She'd never been, with another guy. She fell in love with this guy who really didn't treat her very well and who mooched off of her and all this stuff. So after coming to her own kind of self-realization about, what was important and fighting for herself, why would she take him back? I agree that final shot of them on the, the Ninja Revolution machine in slow motion is so, is so alluring that it almost pulls me over to your side. But in the end, I don't know. It's weird. I think there are definitely problems with both endings. I think the problem with the Ramona ending is, like we were talking about, that she is kind of largely absent for the last part of the movie.
Right.
So it feels like less of a release because she is kind of inactive during the last fight scene. Minor spoilers for the books, but in the book, in the final fight scene, she and Scott fight together against Gideon. And I think if it had been something like that, if they'd gone with that kind of idea, it might feel a little more satisfying for him to end up with Ramona.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Instead of Knives being the one. And I also think that for the Knives ending to work, they would have had to do a lot more with her character throughout the movie. I mean, she's around for longer in the story than she is in the books, and she's an important character, but she's sort of kind of this obsessed, ex-girlfriend, more so than someone who's really kind of looking out for Scott. I don't know. It's tricky. I can see exactly why audiences were split on the ending.
Yeah.
When we first started talking about it, my initial reaction was, no, you're crazy. The original, the theatrical ending is way better. Hearing you talk about it, I can definitely see where you're coming from. It's almost like the only ending that would make sense is for Scott to end up alone, because
I actually was just going to say that, like, because thematically that's sort of what's going on in the theatrical ending, that he's matured and he's, but yeah, you're right, for him to say like, listen, I probably need to be by myself. I'm no good for anyone right now until I figure myself out. Because thematically, that's sort of where he gets to in the theatrical ending, but then he still goes off with Ramona.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's kind of where the moviness of the movie kicks in.
Yeah.
You know, the whole fighting to get the girl, so you got to get the girl in the end type thing.
Well, and I guess – and that's probably maybe why I'm so in love with the Knives ending, because I feel like it's not necessarily a regression for him to go back to Knives, because I don't think he's just going back to this easy thing. I think he's still – reached the same point that he reaches in the Ramona ending. I think he's still grown up. I think he still understands himself better and the way he needs to treat other people. You know, I think all that gets there. And I guess I fall in love with the Knives ending because I am just a sucker for like this romantic happy ending. And that's the way that Knives ending feels for me.
Right.
Whether or not it's true to what should happen, because like you said, why would she take him back? And there are problems with it, but I'm such a sap for that kind of stuff that I fall in love with it. And I feel like it could, I don't know, I feel like it could still work. Neither ending is bad. I don't think the theatrical cut, the theatrical ending hurts the movie or cripples the movie in any way. And honestly, had I never seen the Knives ending, the way it's put together, obviously we wouldn't even be having this discussion, because I would agree that no, he shouldn't go back to Knives. What? That's a step backwards. But having seen the way that he pays it off, I don't know. I almost feel like when it was time to reshoot the ending, he didn't try as hard. And I don't want to say that because I don't want to say anything bad about Edgar Wright. I really love him and he's right there. But I feel like a lot of thought went into the way that the Knives ending was staged. And I feel like the Ramona ending is just sort of rushed and then dropped.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because this, you know, this movie is not a straight adaptation, meaning it's not like these six books came out. People said, oh, we should make this into a movie. They wrote a script and they turned it into a movie. I think the books got optioned by, I guess, Universal. I think back when after the second book came out, and they approached Edgar Wright and said, "We want you to do this."
Okay.
So Edgar Wright and his co-screenwriter, whose name I'm blanking out at the moment, I apologize to whoever that is. Edgar's not telling me for some reason.
Michael Bacall.
Thank you. They went up to Toronto, met with Brian Lee O'Malley, and from that point onward, for the next, you know, three or four books, there was kind of a bit of a collaboration going on where Brian Lee O'Malley would share, you know, what was going to happen, his kind of outlines of what was going to happen in the book, and they would go work on the script. I think they may even have had some small input in the books themselves. That's not to say that, you know, they co-wrote the books at all, but I think some of their reaction to what he was doing, you know, O'Malley would, you know, thought, oh, that's a good idea, and brought it in. So when they did that first ending, when they did the Knives ending, that was before Brian Lee O'Malley had written the end of his book. And you know, even that process, I think at one point O'Malley was going to end the series with Scott on his own, you know, not getting either of them. And again, spoiler for the book, Scott does end up with Ramona. But it's paced a little bit differently. There is more of a sense of, you know, we're starting over again from scratch. Mm-hmm. All this has happened. You know, we're taking a little bit of time apart and then coming back together. It ends in the same way, with the same kind of a leaping off into the unknown through that, you know, the star door. So I think that's why they changed it to what they did. Doesn't make it better, you know, better or worse. I think that it sounds like we agree that they're both fine endings, and they're, you know, there are problems and pros and cons to both of them. But they probably went this way because that's what, you know, O'Malley was going for, and, you know, and for the character reasons we talked about. So I don't know. It sounds to me like what we've really established is that Edgar Wright is so good that he can make two completely different endings that we can both love.
Yeah. I just wish he would have done it like Clue the movie, where you could go to different theaters and see him in one ending. he could end up with Kim Pine, you know.
That would in the books as a whole, I mean, Kim Pine is a character who gets kind of short shrift in the movie. She's much more kind of fleshed out in the books. And then there's a whole backstory with her and Scott where, you know, it's referenced in the movie, but, you know, that they dated at high school. And so he has to deal with, you know, the emotional damage he caused to her and stuff, which they kind of ignore, although there is a bonus feature on the Blu-ray that was done for Adult Swim that kind of illustrates a story with Scott and Kim that was from the books from their high school days. So,
well, and it's interesting because I feel like there's an instance where brevity almost serves the movie better, because I think for the movie to sort of be slavishly literal to the books and go into all that, or even just include, you know, some long flashback sequence or something where they explain all that, I think would have been unnecessary, because I feel like all of that comes across in a very small amount of screen time. And maybe that's just a testament again to, you know, Alison Pill's performance, or just the economy of the moments between those characters, because I feel like I get their whole relationship, and I get why she's angry, and I get what happened with them, without any of that necessarily being spelled out. So, you know, and in a book, sometimes that's great because, again, it's just you can give sort of a richer backstory and go into these characters. You have time in a way that you don't in a movie. But I feel like that all comes across in the movie.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the, you know, the best things about the movie is that simply as an adaptation, it's so impressive. I mean, I think there are very few really, really impressive adaptations, you know, of books that go to movies where the movie is either too slavishly devoted to the book that it assumes that the viewer knows the source material, or just adds things that don't make sense and just to kind of bridge things. I mean, you know, another recent episode, you guys were talking about Harry Potter, the Harry Potter series. And I mean, that's a series of movies that I don't particularly care for that reason, that they always seem like they're just rushed. You know, it's just kind of a rush from beginning to end, and there really isn't any room for things to develop because they have to fit all this stuff in. I mean, they're massive novels.
Right.
But this is where something like Scott Pilgrim, which is it's a massive series, what they cut out, they did so well. And the way that they presented the relevant material is just – it's so – like economy is a great word. And it's these little bits and pieces. I mean, the way that they kind of put in that they the phone call between Envy and Scott, it just gives enough of their history to make what follows, you know, make sense. It kind of gets the whole Envy drama across in, you know, a relatively short amount of screen time. I mean, she is hardly in the movie, you know, except for obviously the fight scene between Scott and Brandon Routh. But they get that across. You get that idea. So it's really pretty impressive. I think it's also impressive because it's, it takes what was good about the comic book format, and you forget the comic book version of the story, and translates it to the screen without making it feel like they're just trying to make a comic book on screen.
Right, right.
It takes, you know, Edgar Wright knows what makes a movie a movie, and what makes a comic book a comic book, and then picks the best, you know, the most compatible things, and brings them together.
Right, yeah, something like Sin City, which, I mean, is still a movie that I like, but is very much just as literal a translation of the comic books as it possibly can be, whereas Scott Pilgrim obviously seems more interested in functioning as a movie first, and then, you know, drawing influence from the comic books or drawing inspiration from the comic books, but working as a movie first, whereas Sin City again seemed to be trying as hard as it could to just reproduce the comic book.
And I think that's a problem with a lot of adaptations, a lot of you know, movie properties that come from other source material. You know, they make a movie because they know people, you know the original, know and love the original. I think that's kind of what's starting to plague superhero movies now as well. I mean, it's kind of neat that Marvel has their own, like, you know, the film series and studio, but there's no real reason to have, you know, the Marvel movies other than people. I've heard of Captain America. I've heard of Iron Man.
Right.
And it's kind of quickly running into the point where the welcome is being worn out pretty quickly, because they're, you know, the comic books are going to be better than the movies, because that's what these characters were designed for. I mean, it's kind of a simple truth that a lot of superheroes look dumb when you see them in real life, whereas they look awesome, awesome on the page. And I have a rather elaborate series of theories that kind of boil down to whether or not a character wears a mask that has white eye holes, or whether you see their eyes and all this kind of stuff. But I think it's one of the reasons why, for me, The Dark Knight is an awesome movie, but the worst scenes are the ones that have Batman in them. Because you have all these, like, this gritty crime drama in this. Right. Even the Joker feels like this real character. And then you have this guy talking to the commissioner in a bat suit. It doesn't make any sense. But
I mean, to that movie's credit, I think it does as good a job as possible.
Absolutely.
Trying to make that believable and create a logic for that. I mean, I guess, you know, the Tim Burton Batmans are, I think, lesser movies, but I guess he does create more of a reality in which you buy a guy in a bat suit.
Right.
Because
right.
Everything's over the top, you know. Everything's a freak show in his movie, so you get the bat suit.
And this is a complete tangent, but I would have loved to see what Christopher Nolan could have done if he'd had the freedom or even the desire, I don't know if he'd want to kind of reinvent the Batman character for that world. I mean, you got that with the Joker. It wasn't just some guy with, you know, white makeup smeared on his face. He felt like a character. What could you do with the Batman character? What would a guy who dresses up in a way that is meant to instill fear in criminals look like in that world?
Yeah. But
that'd be cool.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, you know,
it's like, not going to happen.
Right. Because, you know, the fanboy community would just be up in arms about redesigning Batman.
Even if it made a better movie as opposed to, if you want to read a comic book, read a comic book. If you want to watch a movie, watch a movie.
Well, and I know Scott Pilgrim has a pretty devoted cult following, but, you know, and I'm somebody who tries to stay sort of up on comic books, but I was pretty unfamiliar with it until it was announced as Edgar Wright's next movie. And then it was, you know, and it's based on this series of graphic novels by Brian Lee O'Malley. And so then I was much more aware of it, but I was sort of more aware of what Edgar Wright's next movie was going to be than I was the comic book. So it's interesting that this was made into a movie, because as you said, it's, you know, nowadays it's more just about brand recognition. And so we get a Yogi Bear movie when kids don't know Yogi Bear anymore, but adults do. So maybe they'll go see it. Or, you know, now we're turning board games into movies because, well, people in their 30s played Battleship. So they'll go see a movie called Battleship. Like you said, there's no real reason for, not only is there no real reason for a Thor movie, but I mean, there's even less reason for a Battleship movie. So it's kind of a miracle that a Scott Pilgrim versus the World movie was greenlit in the first place.
Right. And I think going back to your, you know, original point that, you know, this probably isn't the beginning of a movement as much as it is a really impressive one-off, mm-hmm. is that, I mean, this is a self-contained, I hate to use the word gem, but it's a gem of a movie. I mean, it's just kind of just this singular experience that can't be spun off. You're not going to make a sequel for this. You're not going to, you know, take this style and translate it to a different thing. It's Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And the same is true of the comic books. I mean, I think one of the reasons this movie probably works as well as it does is because of the relative obscurity of the source material. You know, it's pretty true. It's very true to the source material, but it's not like, you know, you have to meet this series of criteria, this kind of fanboy checklist for as far as like the mainstream movie-going public is concerned, because they don't know. It's the Wright's credit that it does meet, you know, most of that criteria for someone who really was devoted to the comic book. But it's a special movie.
It is. It's a special movie. seeing as we're wrapping up 2010, is this your favorite movie of the year?
It is. I mean, to be fair, I haven't seen a lot of the major
movies. Well, you already said you haven't seen Cats and Dogs 2.
Not yet. No. I've got
you have to leave some blank spots on your list is what I'm
saying. I do. I'm mostly top 10 list. I'm leaving, you know, 6, 7, 8, and 9 because I feel like I might want to put that movie a few times.
Yeah.
Or whatever is funny. But this definitely kind of struck me as the most well well-realized movie that I saw this year. And I saw Inception, I saw Toy Story 3, I saw, I don't know what else I saw. I don't get to the theater that often, so yeah. I'm kind of a bad movie guy in that way. But I mean, something like Inception, I really, really loved while I was watching it. I didn't take a whole lot away from it. And like I said, because it was so much about the construction of the world and less about the characterizations, you know, I can't give it, you know, quite as high marks as I would Scott Pilgrim. But then again, I don't know. Scott Pilgrim, to me, the fact that it's so rewatchable, the fact that I've, you know, I watched it on Christmas Eve with my sister and my dad, who I never thought in the world, you know, would enjoy it, actually liked it. You know, and he's not at all in the demographic. And then today I was like, oh, let me rewatch it again because we're doing this podcast tonight. And I still found plenty of stuff to enjoy. It's a movie that I will definitely return to time and time again. I really like it.
Edgar Wright's movies, like I think the Coen Brothers movies, to bring it full circle, I think all improve on repeat viewings. And that's I think, rare, and it's a very impressive quality for a movie to have, because most movies obviously are sort of one and done. Movies that not only hold up to repeat viewings but invite them, I think, are a rare breed and a very special thing. And all of his movies, I think, get better the more times you see them. And so does Spaced. I think I only first saw Spaced when it came out on DVD a couple years ago in the United States, and I rewatch it once or twice a year. Mm-hmm. I really, really love that show. And I like it better every time I see it, and I suspect the same will be true of Scott Pilgrim, bad ending or no.
and who knows, maybe in a few years we'll be back together talking about Ant-Man and talk about how much we love that.
So. I kind of hope he does Ant-Man. I don't know. On the one hand, I'm like, I don't need to see him do that particular adaptation, but I guarantee it would be great. So
it would. I mean, that's probably the only reason that I would say, huh, Ant-Man, why not?
Yeah, right. It's the only it's the only thing that would justify an Ant-Man movie.
Pretty much. Pretty much.
Well, thank you very much, Eric, for doing this show with me and talking about Scott Pilgrim for a whole hour.
Was it an hour? I've not been watching the clock. I've been so transported.
I've done nothing but watch the clock.
Thanks for, you know, asking me on. I really appreciate it. And I do love the show.
Well, thank you.
And if you're listening to this and you're not subscribed to the show, you should do so.
Yeah, that's right. You can subscribe in iTunes.
Oh, yeah. That's how I subscribe.
And one of these days, somebody has to email me at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com and tell me how to get more shows in iTunes, because I still haven't cracked the problem of it's only like the 8 or 10 most recent, and I don't know how to make it, you know, every show, because we've done close to 40 shows now, and there's only 8 or 10 available in the iTunes store right now. So if you want to hear all of our past episodes going back to Avatar, that was the first show. It's fthismovie.blogspot.com. You can find all of our shows there.
You might want to just want to take advantage of the fact that they're not all available on iTunes and start, you know, charging a fee maybe for some of the old episodes.
Ooh, very nice.
I'm just, you know, to be completely insidious. I'm kidding, of course. Don't do that because yeah.
I wouldn't even know how to do that, to be honest.
Okay, well, have people send money to me, and we'll figure it out later.
All right, great. Happy 2010, everybody. Thanks for listening. Bye.